Mormon Stories Podcast is made possible through the financial contributions of its listeners. To keep it alive and available to future generations, please consider a donation today at mormonstories.org. Hello and welcome to another edition of Mormon Stories Podcast. My name is John DeLynn. I am your host, and I'm very excited to have a bunch of you with us today online. We're streaming live on the internet. You can, you know, those of you who have found this podcast are finding it through mormonstories.org. But we have with us today some very special guests. I have with me Carrie Krall. Carrie, welcome to Mormon Stories.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be here.
And we also have Morris Thurston. Morris, welcome to Mormon Stories.
Thanks, John. My pleasure.
All right. Well, so I guess this this podcast is a long time coming. So Morris and Carrie, again, thank you so much for joining us. We are also hoping to have Laura Compton here as well, and we're hoping to patch her in soon. But let me just begin by saying that this podcast is long overdue. Proposition 8 happened quite a long time ago. Morris, how long has it been since Proposition 8 went down? Has it been over a year?
Yes, definitely.
A couple years? That,
well, the vote was probably less than 2 years, but when it first it was up and people were campaigning for it was probably 2 years or more ago, actually more.
Yeah, yeah. So Proposition 8's over 2 years old from its beginning. And on Mormon Stories, we've actually never really talked about it explicitly. And I guess the impetus for us talking about Proposition 8, other than the fact that lots of people are interested, was a recent editorial written to the Daily Universe by one Mr. Carrie Krall. So, Carrie, thank you for being the impetus for this podcast.
No problem there.
I think that before we dive in to actually talking about your letter to the editor and what happened, I'd love to go back a little bit and talk a little bit about just sort of how Prop 8 first went down by a couple people who experienced it. So I'm going to assume that both Carrie and Morris were in California when Proposition 8 started heating up. Is that right, Morris?
It's true with me, yes.
And you too, Carrie?
I got there starting in July 2008. So, yes, I was there for a big part of the campaign.
So let's start with you, Carrie. You were serving a mission, right?
Yes, I was. It was the South Carolina Columbia mission.
Okay. So you're serving a mission and you get home. And give us just a few of your recollections.
When I got home, I was very aware that Prop 8 was going on. My first family home evening back home in the singles ward where I was attending, we had a presentation about Proposition 8 from one of the local leaders in the ward. And it was a little strange. A lot of people, of course, were there to just socialize. And then all of a sudden, it turned very serious, very suddenly. And I noticed very quickly that people were presenting arguments for Proposition 8 that I just felt like I needed to look more into. Also, I think the big impetus was to get us out on the streets and to campaign ourselves for Proposition 8. And, you know, I was fresh off a mission. This was nothing new to me. And I was considering what kind of involvement I would have in that effort.
Okay. Now, had you thought a lot about this issue before your mission, Carrie?
I had thought not specifically the issue of gay marriage. There was a time I was probably 12 or 13 when Proposition 22 was going through was up for the vote, and my parents were involved in that as well as my ward. But it didn't really stick. It didn't really hit home at the time what was going on. I was 12 or 13. I was busy, you know, going to soccer practice and watching TV.
So I guess it was kind of a shock for you when you got home from your mission and they're talking about this in singles ward?
It was at a family home evening. I definitely did have, it was presented to me The letter was presented in sacrament meeting. There was a meeting in my home ward where the entire final 2 hours were dedicated to Proposition 8. Right after sacrament meeting, there was a joint meeting with Priesthood and Relief Society where Proposition 8 was discussed. And usually it was under the context of, we're fighting a spiritual war. We need to represent God's will on this issue. And it was a lot of charged rhetoric, very spiritual and emotional rhetoric coming to us.
Yeah. Now, Morris, what are your early recollections?
Well, very much the same as Carrie's. I had, of course, been more mature during the earlier California Prop 22, and so I had something to definitely compare it to. I was there as well when the letter was read. I knew it was going to be, and I knew that I had real issues with that whole the whole idea that this is what our church should be involved in, but I felt that I owed it to the church and to the leaders of the church to attend these meetings, unlike some of my friends who simply boycotted them. So I went, and like Carrie, we had a meeting that was a joint Priesthood Relief Society meeting, and there were talks given. The talks I found to be, what was the word they used in connection with Carrie's letter to take it off?
Offline.
Offensive. I guess that's how I found the talks, because one of the talks was focused on a Meridian magazine article that compared those who would vote against Prop 8 as Satan's minions, because they were appealing to feelings of compassion and all of that, and that's kind of the way Satan got his people involved. And then another talk that was given compared us to the wicked people in Noah's day who didn't listen to their prophet and were destroyed. And so I'd kind of gone in thinking, well, I could just sit there and vote against it and that wouldn't be a problem. But the impression I had coming out of the meeting was that really I would be counted among either Satan's minions or the wicked of the earth if I were to vote against it, and that did offend me.
Let's back up just a tiny bit. Have any of you guys ever heard any theories as to how Proposition 8 got rolling? I've heard that there was not unanimity in the Quorum of the Twelve, that this was something that began maybe on the lower to the mid levels. I've even heard some rumblings about some Catholic official approaching some mid-level LDS official, and some type of agreement was struck for folks in California to start supporting this before top-level leaders were ever looped in. Have any of you ever heard of any of that rumbling at all?
I'm happy to say
right now that I've not.
Okay, Carrie hasn't?
No, and I don't think, John, that is probably accurate. This all dates back even further. It dates back to the campaign in Hawaii, which was even years before Proposition 22, I believe. And I'm sure that at some point this whole idea was brought up obviously the 12 have many people who advise them. We could all speculate as to how it evolved. But I think by the time Prop 8 came along, it's fair to say that that the brethren were at least, for the outside world, unanimous in how they felt.
Okay. So Morris, your thoughts are, your feelings or impressions are that this is something that was planned early on and orchestrated top down from the start.
Yeah, I mean, it followed naturally from what had gone before. It's just that it was taken to a level of involvement that it never had been prior to that. It is as though the church felt this was a line that needed to be drawn in the sand, and they were going to put everything into this campaign.
Yeah.
And I guess I can kind of understand why they would feel like they needed to draw this line in the sand. There's no revelation that accommodates gays within the Doctrine and Covenants. There's no revelation that Joseph gave accommodating, you know, gays in the plan of salvation. You know, the only indications in the scriptures, well, based on the most commonplace interpretations, are that homosexuality is not something, you know, that's acceptable within Christianity, although I know those interpretations have been challenged. But I guess, Carrie, can you kind of see the church's point of view and why they would probably feel like they would need to do something like this?
Based off that reasoning, I have a hard time with it. I think that there are plenty of moral issues that our doctrine don't leave any space for. For some reason, gay marriage was singled out. And especially a big issue I had when I was listening to these arguments is that they weren't explicitly about gay marriage and why gay marriage was wrong. They were about gay adoption. They were about education. They were about the First Amendment. And so I was confused as to why gay marriage specifically was being targeted. So I do understand, I understand why the church has an interest in this issue. I don't understand why if that interest translates into political involvement, why it doesn't do so on many other issues that are very similar.
Right. And I guess you could argue that they have to start somewhere. But Morris, have you spent any time sort of getting in a place of empathy for why the church would feel like it needs to do this?
Well, of course. I can understand why the church feels that its doctrines would preclude gay marriage. I had a much more difficult time understanding why the church felt that it needed to impose its doctrines on others that were not even members of the church through the political process. And that's something I've not been able to kind of get my hands around.
Yeah, and on the boards, Derek says the family proclamation is doctrine. He's basically saying that would be the primary motivation, perhaps, is just a desire to make sure the proclamation of the family is promoted and encouraged, or the values within it. But Morris, you're saying that it's one thing to have a bunch of religious beliefs and doctrine, but it's a different thing to start trying to influence the legislative process. Is that right?
Yeah, and when I first was involved in this, I didn't make any secret of how I felt about the political issue, and I wrote a letter to my bishop explaining why I couldn't support it and would not be contributing to the cause, and he got back, and he, by the way, we've had some very nice conversations, but his first reaction was, well, that's what the proclamation on the family says, and therefore, how can you be against the proclamation on the family? And my response to that was, I'm not against the proclamation on the family. The family talks about the importance of marriage and the sanctity of marriage, and I agree completely with that. The proclamation doesn't say that we have to apply it to people who are not of our faith.
Right. Right. So as this started heating up, one of the big issues that many people have expressed concern about was the extent to which people were individually propositioned to donate money. I'll start with you, Morris. Do you have any stories or anecdotes about the way that the people were often approached to donate?
Well, since I very early on made it clear to my bishop that I was not going to donate, there was no further pressure put on me. However, before I've had things where the people have pressure, and I know how it works. They call in people, and they sort of know how well-heeled you are, and they make it clear if you've got more money, they expect more from you, and if you have less money, they probably expect less. But that's been fairly clear. The only anecdotal story I have that kind of bothered me a lot is someone, ironically, from Arizona, where a similar battle was going on, and the bishop brought in their 89, 90-something-year-old grandmother. I mean, she was very elderly and beginning to suffer from dementia, and got her to agree to give $1,000. They felt that she really wasn't mentally capable of making that sort of an informed decision, and that was a little bit unfair.
Right. How about you, Carrie? Have you heard any stories like that?
I've heard plenty of stories. I haven't experienced any. I heard people, it's not even relevant. I haven't heard any direct stories from anyone in my life about being approached by priesthood leaders, asking them for money. I've heard plenty of stories otherwise that people might as well just go up and look up on the internet, and it's better than hearing it from me.
Right. Now, did both of you guys experience the upping of the rhetoric as the campaign, as the vote neared, where, you know, in sacrament meetings and in Sunday schools and in the quorum meetings, etc., this became a frequent topic of discussion? Morris, we'll ask you first.
It was definitely a frequent topic of discussion, and it would be slipped in even in sacrament meeting talks. I will say this, that as the date for the vote came closer, I had a reason to be in Utah, in staying in a condominium there. And so probably for the last month or so prior to the vote, and during the vote itself, I was actually out of California, and I kind of considered that a blessing.
Yeah. How about you, Carrie? Do you remember any of that?
I also was out of California at the time. I was at BYU, and definitely at BYU, there was an upping of the rhetoric. I would receive emails from someone who was organizing the call campaigns, the call centers, where I had plenty of BYU student friends who were going to call centers to call voters in California to ask them to support Proposition 8. I remember the weekend before the vote, we received an email asking us to come in for an all-day call session. And it was very encouraging, saying, you know, we're almost there. Recent polls are showing that we're pulling ahead. We need this push. I often wondered why I was getting those emails. I hadn't signed up for any list. I also received a phone call, and I wondered where they got my phone number. And I also was approached just walking around campus. There would be students who would ask if you were from California and would ask if you would be involved in the campaign and try and sign you up right there to do so. So definitely all of those things I take, they were definitely a step up from where I was comfortable politically and getting involved.
So BYU is really leveraged as a resource for the campaign. Is that right?
Well, I don't know where they got my information. I can assume BYU definitely had my information of where I was from, what my phone number was, and what my email address was. But there was nothing that was tying those emails or phone calls specifically to BYU.
Interesting. Just one sec, Morris. There's a comment on the forum from a John Smith. It says, the members of my ward were asked to make meals for BYU students so that they would have more time to work at the call centers. We were also asked to clean their apartments. That's interesting. I haven't heard that.
That would have been nice.
Morris, were
you going to...
Just for that reason alone. Morris, were you going to jump in?
Well, I was just going to say that, because I think this is kind of relevant to the whole issue of how much pressure was put on. I very early on had communications with a couple of general authorities and explained my position. They were friends of mine, and I consider them friends still, and they were very gracious and kind in discussing it with me. And it was made clear to me that I think there was a big misunderstanding that was never clarified for most people, and that is, although we may have a moral belief or there may be a moral issue involving homosexual marriage, we do not tell people, the church does not tell people how to vote. Now that seems like it's kind of contrary to what the letter said, but if you read the letter specifically, it didn't actually tell you how to vote. And I was told that since the issue was had arisen in the political arena, I could use my own judgment about how to vote on it, and that would not be something the church would be taking any action on one way or the other. This was confirmed later when there was kind of a little bit more flack going, and there were some articles in the Salt Lake Tribune. Peggy Fletcher Stack did a couple of them. And Whitney Clayton, Elder Clayton, who was kind of in charge of the California effort, affirmed that and said that we're not taking action against people because of, I mean, they're free to vote how they will, and we consider them in full fellowship in the church. Now, that being said, I've also heard anecdotally of people who went, who had action taken against them for coming out and stating what their beliefs were and how they intended to vote. I never did. But I think that it varied a lot according to who your local bishop and stake president was.
Gotcha. Now, let me just see. Laura Compton, are you on the line?
I am. Can you hear me?
Oh, Laura, I'm so glad you could join us.
It only took about 5 computers, but we're here.
I don't mean to interrupt the conversation we're having, but Laura, you were one of the co-founders of Mormons for Marriage, and I think you've been one of the most interviewed people, along with Morris, I think, in the country on this issue. So why don't you fill in any reflections you have for what we've discussed so far?
Well, the only part that I've been able to hear is just Morris's recent message about things just being kind of depending on who your local leaders are is kind of how your situation went. So because of my connection issue, I haven't really been able to follow the conversation, so I'm not sure where you guys are. But
well, why don't you just talk to us about how you experienced the run up to the vote on Prop 8, and what your reflections were as being an active Mormon while the Prop 8 thing was raging in Northern California.
I think I was, having lived through Prop 22 10 years previous to this, my big issue with Proposition 8 was going to be that, you know, we just did this 10 years ago. We had people leaving the church. We had people committing suicides. We had people, wards just completely divided and over the top, politicizing everywhere. And I just didn't want to live through that again. I think the message has already been out there that I contacted my bishopric and stake presidency quite early, before the letter was read, right after it was leaked to the internet, and told them how I felt. And gave them copies of Carolyn Pearson's book, No More Goodbyes, Circling the Wagons Around Our Loved Ones, and pled with my leaders to really make a difference in our ward, that they were our shepherds and that they had responsibilities for their whole flocks. And they really took that to heart. And while there was political things done in our wards and in our stake, I think that they really tried very hard to make it a place where it was not over-the-top politics all the time. And I can think of several times when people would start saying things in the ward and somebody from the bishopric would say, you know, this isn't the place or the time for that. So my experience in my ward was that I could make a difference and that people could make a difference and that when we stood up and talked, that made a difference.
Right. Yeah, and so you did.
And then I hear people, you know, the next stake over who were being called on the carpet, and I hear people being stressed out. And when we got Mormons for Marriage set up, we had lots of people coming, writing both on the conversation in comments to posts, but also privately contacting us saying, thank you so much. I know I'm not alone. And that was a big difference between Prop 8 and Prop 22, is to have a community, especially an online community, where you know you're going to be isolated in one person in a ward or a couple people in a ward. But having an online community like the Mormon Stories community really made a big difference for a lot of people, I think.
So this may be stating the obvious, but I don't think it is, actually. I want to go around the horn. We'll start with Laura, then Morris, then Carrie. And I want to hear why, Laura, you felt like Prop 8 was something you wanted to fight.
I didn't want to see anywhere people dying. You know, we've had lots of issues in the church with blacks in the priesthood and with feminism and with gambling and working on Sundays. People aren't killing themselves over that. We don't see young gay members killing themselves. And I wanted to make sure that nobody who knew that I was around felt like every single person was against them. I really want them to have the safety net and to realize that, you know, somebody is listening to them and somebody's noticing that. And that's why it was so important to me. And, you know, if you're going to protect families, gay families are as much family as straight families.
Okay. So that's, I mean, that can't get any more serious, I guess. For you, it was a matter of life and death.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Morris, how about you?
Well, I love to quote myself. So when I wrote a letter to the church authorities, what I said was, I feel the church's involvement is a mistake. In my opinion, banning gay marriages in California, A, will do very little to strengthen the family, certainly far less than initiatives aimed at strengthening the bonds of heterosexual marriage. B, has caused and will continue to cause further alienation and despair among our gay brothers and sisters who cannot be blamed for their same-sex attraction. And C, places the church in a position of trying to dictate politics to those who are not members of our church, a position that's proved disastrous throughout our history from Missouri to Illinois to Utah. And of those three, the most important for me, the one that I came back to and stressed at the end, was the feeling that we're not accommodating our gay and lesbian brothers and sisters who are, and I've talked to many of them, who are often among the very strongest members of the ward growing up in their youth quorums, on missions, have a lot to offer from a spiritual and every other basis in our church organization, and yet something like Prop 8 just serves to drive the wedge further there, and I'd like to see that wedge removed.
All right. How about you, Carrie?
Oh, for me, I was keenly aware of how I felt during the entire campaign and afterwards, and it didn't feel good. I felt like I was betraying my own conscience and my own ability to reason. And I didn't know what else I could trust if I couldn't trust those things. It's still a matter of a lot of serious consideration for me in prayer. But where I really took my stand and where I continue to take my stand is that I want people to be honest about why they support Proposition 8. I don't think that when any of these arguments that were being used to support it were shown to be weak by Morris and by Judge Walker and other people. I mean, I know that's still debatable. Some of them might be supported later. That I don't think it changed anyone's mind. And I don't think that those were the reasons people were supporting Proposition 8 in the first place. And I do think that those reasons were deeply offensive to gays and lesbians inside the church and outside the church. How are you going to tell a lesbian parent who's not LDS that she can't possibly be a good parent, and not base it on any study, but base it on your own religious belief? She's the one who has children. And she's the one who's raising them as best as she can. And that's a very difficult thing to say to someone without any sort of rational, non-religious source to point to. And so because of those things, I really felt strongly that people need to be honest about their opinions on Proposition 8.
Yeah, and we'll definitely get to that, Carrie. And I'll just ask sort of a quick follow-up. I'll just ask this to Nadine and Morris. Do either of you, you know, there's a lot of members of the church that don't feel like you guys do, and there's speculation as to what makes someone care about this issue versus not. And usually it seems to be because you have a close loved one who's gay. Laura, is there someone close to you that made you particularly sensitive to this issue that you're comfortable talking about?
I had a lot of friends and coworkers at work. I grew up in the same state as Stuart Mattis, so that was a turning point for me. But it might.
Do you remember Stuart Mattis? Did you know him?
He was a friend of my brother. I knew his sister more, but we're about the same age.
But you knew his family.
Yes, I knew his family. His father was in our stake presidency. He was in the bishopric of the singles ward. So yeah, I knew them. You couldn't live in the stake and not know who the Mattises were. They were very energetic, and they still are. And I think that they have really, within the construct of Mormon theology and practice, have really reached out to some gay men in Utah, especially, and have done some real hard work in working to make things a little bit safer within the parameters that they feel comfortable.
And was this in Southern California?
Northern California.
Okay, so you're from the Bay Area as well?
Yes.
Okay. Wow, so you knew Stuart Mattis's family, and so you remember the day you heard about his suicide?
I have to say,
Laura, we just had a listener. This is the beauty of the internet and the internet forum. We just had a listener say, "Who is Stuart Mattis?"
There is a whole bunch of information about him at our site, Mormons for Marriage, and I will put a link in the chat room right now.
Why don't you give a 30-second?
Stuart Mattis was a young gay man who's about 32 years old, and 3 weeks before the California vote on Proposition 22, which is exactly the same thing as Prop 8, except that instead of changing the Constitution, it just changed the law. Stuart Mattis shot himself on the steps of the Los Altos Stake Center in Los Altos, California.
With a note pinned to his chest that said, "Do not."
The note said, "Do not resuscitate." His story is spoken about a little bit there's a wonderful chapter about him in Carolyn Pearson's book. Stuart tried very, very hard to be righteous, to not have gay feelings, and to really suppress and tried to get rid of his gay attraction. He found that the only way that he could live with himself was to not live anymore. It was very, very sad and very hard to talk about sometimes. But we had a wonderful memorial for him it was 10 years ago, 10 years ago in March that he did that. And his parents, you know, have a lot of concerns about using Stuart. We talked about that on the Mormons for Marriage website, so
okay,
you can go there.
Okay, Morris, is there anything you're comfortable talking about in terms of what gave you a personal connection to this issue?
Sure. Although I will say this, John, while it's true that many people who support gay marriage have a personal connection, I think there are those who do not. And more tellingly, there are people who have a very close personal connection who are among the most bitter advocates of or strong advocates of Prop 8 and banning same-sex marriage. So
right.
It doesn't necessarily mean that that's the way you're going to go. But my wife's brother, my brother-in-law, was gay. He's a younger brother, and we just knew him as a kid growing up in church and, you know, great speaker, very fine musician, piano player, the sort of guy that every mother would want their daughter to date, never got in any trouble. And then discovered that he was gay. And for him, this was fairly early in this whole procedure, and I didn't understand much about gay issues at all at the time. And Richard ended up, he contracted AIDS and died. and my wife was on his deathbed, and I went to with her to the funeral. He had joined a church up there that was welcoming to gays, and a number of people just stood there and spoke at a little memorial service for him, stood up and spoke, and I heard all these people standing and speaking and realizing that they were all, it was actually a gay church, so gay and lesbians, and they were all that way, and they just, afterwards in talking to them, they seemed like such fine people. Many of them were in committed relationships, and I just kind of got a new outlook myself. I'd never thought about it much before I started thinking about it, and from that point on, I never could see the point in the churches wanting to be against the sort of committed relationships that I saw in that room. It seemed like what the church should be doing, on the contrary, is encouraging those kinds of relationships.
Right. Well, let's move to a bit of that, Morris. So I guess the church got in some type of consortium, and some marketing firm or PR firm was brought on, and they started really ramping up the public relations effort as it related to Proposition 8. And Morris, one of the areas where you entered the scene really strongly in all this was a response you made to a document called Six Consequences if Proposition 8 Fails. So Morris, why don't you give us some background on that document? Talk us through what the document stated. Tell us if you know who wrote the document or its origins, and then talk about your response to it and why you found, as a Harvard-trained lawyer, I guess, why you found it not to be accurate according to the law.
Okay. Maybe there's one thing I'd like to say before that, John, and that is that my feelings on this issue, I've always considered to be my personal feelings, and you know, I don't make any claim to being a prophet. And I don't make any claim to my personal feelings about the wisdom of gay marriage and how we should treat our gay brothers and sisters. I don't make claims that those are or should be what the church does. They're just what I believe. People have asked me, well, how can you believe that way if obviously the brethren seem to feel otherwise, and my response to that is that I have never viewed anyone in the church from the prophet on down as claiming infallibility on every single thing that's ever said, and I think that there's room for people to have their own opinions within the church, their own personal opinions, so long as they don't preach it as this is the doctrine. And so that's where I am. I have very good friends who supported Prop 8 and who continue to support the principles behind Prop 8. I don't disown them from my friendship, and they don't disown me from their friendship. And I grant them the right to believe the way they believe if they'll grant me my right. So with that preface, getting back to the document, when I looked at the document, just something about it, everything about it seemed wrong to me. It was called Six Consequences the Coalition in Support of Proposition 8 Has Identified If Proposition 8 Fails. And as I read through them, I realized that every single one of the so-called consequences were legal consequences. And I thought, well, who's any better qualified to look into this than me? I've been practicing law for 35 years, and I'm not altogether an idiot, so let me see what's behind all of this. And as I looked at it, as I looked at the cases that seemed to underlie it, I kind of got more and more angry because I felt that it really was a misleading document. Now, what you have to understand is that in California, even before Prop 8, gays and lesbians, homosexuals were accorded all of the civil rights that married couples had. That is, not only were they accorded the rights of individuals, the non-gay individuals, but also their relationships, their registered relationships had the same consequences as the marriage relationship. So other than the fact that it wasn't called that. So to identify these as consequences that would happen if we didn't vote for Prop 8 seemed pretty ridiculous. And I'll just run through them real quick. The first one says, California children in public schools will have to be taught, and that was underlined, have to be taught that same-sex marriage is just as good as traditional marriage. And then the flyer identified the supposed code of the education code section that required that. Well, I looked into that, and the code section says nothing of the type. It says that pupils will receive instruction to aid them in making decisions of matters of personal, family, and community health. The focus was on health. There's another section that deals with sex health education and HIV/AIDS prevention, and it provides that instruction shall be age-appropriate and medically accurate, and shall teach respect for marriage and committed relationships. So that was already part of the law. Nothing with gay marriage was going to change that. It wasn't going to require teachers to teach, for example, kindergartners about, or even that gay marriage was a good thing or a bad thing, or make any judgment whatsoever. And later, there were several editorials in the newspapers that supported that view. I know there are people that disagree with that, but if they look at the law, they're not going to find it.
Okay.
The second issue was churches may be sued over their tax-exempt status if they refuse to allow same-sex marriage ceremonies in their religious buildings open to the public. Ask whether your pastor, priest, minister, bishop, or rabbi is ready to perform such marriages in your chapels and sanctuaries. Well, that's a very inflammatory statement, and I know members of our church who were convinced that if Prop 8 passed, we were going to have to start marrying gay people in our temples. And it was absurd. So I looked at what was behind that, and I had been following all of this stuff pretty closely, and it seemed clear that the one case they were basing that on was one involving an affiliate of the Methodist Church in New Jersey. Now, New Jersey was a state that did not allow gay marriages, so obviously this had nothing to do with gay marriages. But in that case, an affiliate, not the church itself, had a pavilion that it opened to the public and collected fees for, or actually allowed people to use for various things, such as marriages and other things as well. And there was a tax provision that said, if you make that type of facility available to the public, you can get a property tax exemption, which is what they did. However, then they decided, well, we can't allow people to have a gay commitment ceremony here. And basically New Jersey said, you can't do that. Once you've taken this tax exemption and you've said that anyone can use it for any purpose, you can't suddenly decide to discriminate. So the additional tax that this little affiliate was required to pay amounted to $200. It made it sound like the entire church property or income tax exemption would be taken away, and it didn't have anything to do with that at all.
Okay.
The next one was religious adoption agencies will be challenged by government agencies to give up their long-held right to place children only in homes with both a mother and a father. Catholic Charities in Boston already closed its doors in Massachusetts because the courts legalized same-sex marriage there. Well, Catholic Charities, number one, didn't close its doors, and still hasn't. What it did do, Catholic Charities was an arm of the government in Massachusetts. They received money for providing adoption services, and they were, and they took adoptions assigned. They basically act as an arm of the state. They were allowed by the state to take non-Catholic adoptions and kind of run the adoption program. And at some point, it became clear that this they might have to start placing children with gay couples because you couldn't discriminate there. And in fact, they already had done that. But some members of the board of that got upset and said, well, we're just going to stop doing the adoptions altogether then. And so they voluntarily withdrew from it. The fact of the matter is that the Mormon Church is still provides adoption services there. No one has ever been asked or required to place a child with a gay couple if they don't want to, because we do voluntary adoptions. We don't do state-mandated adoptions. And furthermore, in California, we already, before Prop 8 ever came along, prohibited discrimination in state-operated adoption services. So that hasn't changed and never will change. And to my knowledge, no LDS adoption service has ever been required to do anything that would involve gay adoption.
Okay.
Next, and we're getting there, I know this is kind of long. Number four was religions that sponsor private schools with married student housing may be required to provide housing for same-sex couples, even if counter to church doctrine, or risk lawsuits over tax exemptions and related benefits. Again, this didn't seem to me to really apply to the church. First of all, we don't have any church schools in California that I'm aware of that provide married student housing. So Prop 8 wasn't going to change that. And the case that underlies this one is a case in New York which didn't have gay marriage. So, you know, you don't need gay marriage to reach this kind of a result. So it just, again, it seemed to be a reason to vote against Prop 8 that had no underlying basis. California's existing non-discrimination laws give all registered domestic partners, whether heterosexual or homosexual, the right of equal access to family housing. So that wasn't going to change. Ministers, the next one is number five. Ministers who preach against same-sex marriage may be sued for hate speech and risk government fines. It has already happened in Canada, a country that legalized gay marriage. A recent California court held that municipal employees may not say, quote, traditional marriage, quote, or family values, quote, because after the same-sex marriage case, it is hate speech. Well, this is one of the more ridiculous ones, because in America, in the United States, we have a First Amendment. We don't have hate speech. They do have hate speech laws in Canada and some other places. The Canadian case that was being referred to involved not a minister, but a private citizen who put bumper stickers on his car that basically said that someone engaged in homosexuality should be put to death, and they considered that hate speech. There's been kind of a similar case in Sweden. First of all, I could never see our church publicly saying that homosexuals should be put to death. So that kind of hate propaganda would never even emanate from the church to begin with. And even if it did, in America, you're completely free to say that. The California case that they referred to was the Good News Employee Association versus Hicks. And essentially, it was a group that disagreed it was a blatantly homophobic message. It was a flyer that they put on the walls of the workplace to preserve our workplace with integrity, with respect for the natural family marriage and family values. And this was a workplace that included a number of gay and lesbian workers. And they were told that to respect workplace etiquette, that they should take it down. And the court found that their employer was perfectly entitled to do that.
Okay.
And that's the last one was it'll cost you money, it'll bring a cascade of lawsuits, blah, blah, blah. You know, everything brings lawsuits. And as far as costing money, Prop 8, the official flyer said that it would be a net benefit to California because it would bring an influx of revenue because of the anticipated increase in marriage ceremonies, and actually be a boon to the economy. So I didn't think that was very you know, made much sense.
Right.
That was pretty well it, John.
Okay. Well, Morris, when you thank you for doing that, and this is a very important article. Real quick, do we know who wrote these 6 points?
Well, at the time, I didn't. It was anonymous. It wasn't signed. But later, Gary Lawrence said he had written it, so I will.
And who is that? Who is that?
Gary Lawrence is a he's down here in Southern California, in Orange County. He is a political advisor, public relations type guy. He's written a book recently that I actually has some very good points in it about how we present ourselves to the public. And argues that we should do better with our public relation efforts than we have, and I actually agree with him on that. He's very respected by many people. He's been a former bishop, I believe, and but he is a political. I mean, that's his business, and he does get paid for what he does. And the church was paying him, as I understand it, to run this campaign. He was essentially running the California campaign from the ground level.
His title was grassroots coordinator.
Yeah.
As far as the campaign was, he was also involved in Prop 22. He was also involved in Hawaii same-sex marriage stuff in 1997. He has Lawrence research.
So this guy's really, really instrumental. He's really central to this whole thing.
He's been involved for a long time.
Have you met him, Morris?
I have. I was actually spoke on the same program with him.
Oh, wow. Huh. Interesting. Well, seems like he's a pretty key figure here.
Yeah, he is in California, I think.
Yeah. So Morris, one last thing. Apparently, Jeff Holland's, Elder Holland's son, Matthew Holland, was integrally involved in this campaign as well. Is that right?
I really don't know. Maybe Laura does.
He was a board member on the National Organization for Marriage, which is the group that got Proposition 8 onto the ballot. They got enough signatures to get onto the ballot. National Organization for Marriage has been involved in lots of traditional marriage campaigns since the Prop 8 campaign. The person who replaced Matthew Holland on the board was Orson Scott Card.
Right.
And there have been intimations that Mormon roots run deeper than that, but I'm not aware of the details of that.
Right. And this is the same Matt Holland that's now the president of Utah Valley University, right?
Yes.
Okay, so Morris, real quick, before we get to Carrie and our listeners, or Carrie, I want you to know that our listeners are clamoring to hear from you.
Oh, wow. I better wake up. No, just kidding. I've been enjoying it.
you're a rock star. But before we do that, Morris, what was the reaction? I remember something on Meridian Magazine in response to your six consequences. Is that right? Is my memory serving me correctly?
Yeah, there was. I had a lot of reaction. Someone, I think, maybe a professor at BYU wrote something on Meridian. I had other people posting stuff on the internet that was supposedly a rebuttal of what I said. Some of them were pleasant. Some of them were unpleasant. Some of them either accused me directly or indirectly of not being a true Mormon. And so it was a kind of stressful time for me. But, I guess whenever you say something controversial, as I read recently in a book that I really enjoyed called The Help, I think that they said that if you're going to write about something, don't write about something that everyone agrees with. It's not worthwhile.
So I bet that was hard, Morris. Did you get any grief from leaders or you know, people in leadership?
No, I really didn't. And in fact, I got some support. I will say that the two general authorities that I spoke to were both very supportive. And later, when my stake president inquired, because people did I know that people did suggest to my stake president that perhaps he should take some sort of action against me. When that happened, he told me that he contacted these general authorities, and they both vouched for me. So I did not receive any problem from above.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. To comment on this episode or to discuss it with others, please check us out online at mormonstories.org. If you want to find other friends, family members, former missionary companions, or ward members who approach Mormonism like you, consider adding me, John DeLynn, as your Facebook friend. This may seem like a strange idea, but many of my closest friends have discovered that they are not alone in their thoughts or feelings or family or even a ward situation through discovering mutual Facebook friends. Finally, to keep Mormon Stories alive, please consider a donation at mormonstories.org. Music on this episode was provided by Clayton and Sky Pixton.
Nearer, my God, to thee. Nearer.